el Alto Comisionado de las Naciones Unidas para los Derechos Humanos. En esta ocasión nos acompaña el relator especial Magna Kiai. Su mandato tiene que ver con los derechos a la libertad de reunión pacífica y de asociación. El señor Kiai, de nacionalidad keniata, ha estado en Chile desde el día 21 de septiembre llevando a cabo una misión para conocer en profundidad cómo se viven y se respetan estos derechos a la libertad de reunión pacífica y asociación en el país, y para ello se ha reunido con diversas autoridades de gobierno, parlamentarios, organizaciones de la sociedad civil, distintas asociaciones, ¿verdad?, para justamente conocer un poco más de la realidad de Chile. Y a raíz de esa misión de observación, él, digamos, ha podido hacer un análisis y el día de hoy va a compartir con todos nosotros sus observaciones preliminares en relación a la visita a Chile. Así que, sin más, les dejo con el señor Kiai. Mr. Kiai, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for coming to this press briefing, in which I will be reporting on my preliminary findings after this official mission to Chile. I will read it, and I hope that it's clear, and hopefully you can catch the Spanish in, quite clearly. I would like, first of all, to thank the government of the Republic of Chile for inviting me to undertake this official mission here, my first to the Americas. I view this as a positive sign of the government's willingness to engage in a constructive dialogue on the rights to freedom of peaceful assembly and of association, among other human rights. I am the fourth UN Special Rapporteur to visit Chile since July 2013, which I believe is an indication that the government is serious about meeting its obligations under international human rights law. I'd also like to thank the government for its exemplary cooperation in organizing the mission, particularly in light of the earthquake that struck Chile on September 16th. The resulting emergency situation could have led to the cancellation of this mission, but the government pushed forward. I have had fruitful exchanges with the members of the executive, legislative, and judicial branches in Santiago, Valparaíso, Temuco, and Copiapó. I benefited immensely from the assistance of Chile's excellent national human rights institution, the National Institute for Human Rights, Instituto Nacional de Derechos Humanos, who are here today, and I'm grateful for everyone's tenacity in making sure the mission went through as scheduled. In addition, I met with brave human rights activists, including members of civil society organizations, Mapuche leaders, student leaders, and members of trade unions who are engaged in critically important work to strengthen democracy and human rights in Chile. Their work and courage has contributed significantly to the progress that Chile has made to date. I also met with farmers and truck owners in Temuco. Chile has made enormous strides since its return to democracy 25 years ago. It epitomizes the democracy dividend, that is, the benefits and progress that can accrue when a country turns from dictatorship. Poverty has been drastically reduced, the economy diversified, and the country has found firm footing among the more developed countries in the world. Most importantly, the country has made great progress in areas of democracy and human rights. The brutal atrocities of the dictatorship era are in the rearview mirror. Political change now happens peacefully, regularly, and democratically. And human rights hold an important place in the government's agenda, evidenced, for example, by the fact that Chile co-sponsored the Human Rights Council resolution establishing my mandate in 2010 and the subsequent ones, as well as the resolution on civil society space. But it is not all perfect. From my meetings with government and civil society, it is clear that the country faces deep and significant social challenges. There is the Mapuche land issue, which is a complex emotional topic that stretches back more than centuries ago. There are labor and union issues, with workers grappling with outsourcing issues and a changing economic environment. And there are the educational reform issues symbolized by the student protest movement. It is not my role in this mandate to pass judgment on the issues that underlie these conflicts or on the merits of those on either side of the arguments. Rather, my mandate deals with assessing how Chile is doing in giving people the tools to address these conflicts peacefully and legitimately, namely the rights to freedom of peaceful assembly and of association. These rights are not, of course, the only tools to address social conflict, but I believe they are among the best we have. They allow underrepresented groups such as the youth, the poor, and indigenous peoples to amplify their voice. They give dispossessed people a channel for engagement and a stake in society. And above all, they allow us to thrash out our disagreements in a peaceful, even if messy, manner. In the big picture, assembly and association rights are relatively healthy in Chile. However, there are areas for improvement, and it is important that for Chile to address these, both for the consolidation of its own democracy and in order to take its rightful place as a global leader in human rights. Clearly, Chile's most significant challenge is the fact that some vestiges of dictatorship remain, despite its advances over the past 25 years. The transition was not a clean break, but rather a gradual one, leaving remnants of yesteryear that have no place in the Chile of today. A central feature of the dictatorship era was a severe restriction of rights emanating from the securitization of the state. By contrast, a democratic dispensation elevates and preserves rights, making limitations the exceptions. The ghost of this era looms particularly large over the security sector, chiefly the police, and specifically the special forces, and their function in policing social conflicts and assemblies. During my visit, I heard repeated examples of this in multiple and varied contexts relating to excessive use of force, the failure to weed out violent elements at gatherings while cracking down more brutally on peaceful protesters, the harassment of activists, and impunity following these abuses, and more. This situation represents a significant obstacle to the free exercise of assembly and association rights and weakens their effectiveness as a tool to peacefully address social conflict precisely at the moment that Chile needs them most. I understand that these rights can be messy and disruptive sometimes. Protests can be inconvenient and rowdy, but they're better than the alternative, which is violence. With this overview, I would like to address a few specific areas of concern. Freedom of peaceful assembly. First, Chile's legal framework governing the exercise of the right to freedom of peaceful assembly needs to be brought into full compliance with international human rights law. While the Chilean constitution recognizes this right, its exercise is unduly restricted by Supreme Decree 1086 of 1983, which allows local officials to prevent or dissolve assemblies that have not been previously authorized or permitted by authorities, and to deny permission for assemblies deemed to disrupt public transit, among other things. The fact that assemblies have been routinely authorized in the last few years does not prevent the use of this decree in later years. Indeed, we saw the use of this decree recently with regard to the proposed protest by truck owners from Temuco who were trying to drive into Santiago. Best practice dictates that states may, at most, require prior notification for peaceful assemblies, not authorization. Assemblies, by their natures, can cause a certain degree of disruption. The purpose of this notification is to allow authorities to facilitate the exercise of the right to peaceful assembly and to take measures to protect protesters, public safety, order, and the rights and freedoms of others in that order. Requiring authorization turns the right to freedom of peaceful assembly into a privilege, and such a system is not compatible with international human rights law and best practices, nor is it compatible with Chile's own constitution. Supreme Decree 1086 is a remnant of Chile's past and has no place in the Chile of today, and I urge the authorities to repeal it as soon as possible. Chile's police protocols on the management of protests, which were only recently made public, contain some positive principles that seek to enable protests, but they should be improved. For instance, the protocols deem a protest violent if the instructions of the police are contravened. In addition, the protocols state that it is advisable to hold organizers accountable for acts committed by participants. Moreover, there seems to be a lack of practical guidance as to how to implement and monitor the implementation of these protocols. My biggest concern during this visit relates to the practical management of protests especially the role of the special forces. I make a distinction here between ordinary police officers and PDI who reportedly fulfill their functions adequately and who enjoy respect among the population, and the special forces who regularly use excessive force when managing protests. Police brutality has occurred in the context of street protests by students demanding education reform, culminating in 2011. The special forces used rubber bullets, paintball guns, tear gas, and water cannons, wanakos, sometimes with dramatic consequences. In 2013, Enrique Ekin, while on his way home from taking part in a protest for better education in Santiago, was hit by a rubber bullet fired by a police officer, causing him to lose sight in his right eye. In May 2015, Rodrigo Aviles, who was participating in a student protest in Valparaiso, was knocked out for 2 months due to the inappropriate use of a water cannon. The police have justified the dispersal of protests and the recourse to force by pointing to the presence of disruptive individuals in the margins of such protests. Let me be clear. The police have the duty to distinguish between peaceful demonstrators and agents provocateurs. The presence of a few people engaging in violence in and around a protest does not authorize police to brand the entire protest violent. It does not give the state carte blanche to use force against or arrest everyone indiscriminately. Rather, the violent elements should be extracted from the protest and dealt with in accordance with the rule of law. In fact, the persistent failure in dealing with these few violent people raises questions about the reasons for inaction by the police, as these violent protesters mar the image and effectiveness of public protests. Extracting these violent few requires skill, training, and dedication on the part of the police. But after meeting with authorities around the country, I am confident that Chile's police forces can indeed handle this situation. The police have also resorted over the years to excessive use of force in the context of protests by Mapuche, who have called for the respect of their rights, especially land rights. Recently, the premises of the National Corporation for Indigenous Peoples Development, CONADI, in Temuco were peacefully occupied for several weeks by some members of a Mapuche community, including women and children. The special forces operation to clear the occupation was reportedly excessive and in complete disregard of the fact that there were children in the premises. They also breached the court order that required the presence of INDH in any action to evacuate the premises. I'm also particularly disturbed by the killing in July 2015 in El Salvador of Nelson Quechillo, a copper contract mine worker who was shot dead by special forces who used live ammunition during a protest calling for better pay and benefits. Authorities claim that the protest was not entirely peaceful. However, the police response raises serious questions regarding proportionality of responses. Individuals retain at all times their rights to life and physical integrity, even if they become violent during protests, and it is the state's duty to safeguard these rights. An investigation has been opened into the case, which I welcome, and I trust it will be conducted in an impartial, transparent, and thorough manner, with a view to shedding full light on this tragedy as the best way to ease the tensions among the copper workers community. I was also alerted to a number of cases involving allegations of sexual harassment against female student and Mapuche demonstrators detained during protests. I find these claims deeply troubling. I note the authorities' response to these claims by allowing the INDH to monitor detention facilities, and I look forward to a similar positive response in holding the perpetrators accountable. Taken together, I believe the issues highlighted indicate an urgent need for police to change their mindset in the context of assemblies and protest. Under international law, this role is clear. They are there first to facilitate and protect peaceful assemblies and protests. And I am pleased to let you know that in March 2016, I will present, together with my colleague Christoph Haynes, Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Summary and Arbitrary Executions, a compilation of practical recommendations for the proper management of assemblies. A number of these recommendations will be of particular relevance to the situation in Chile, and I will share this compilation with the Director General of the Police and other authorities as once it is available. I will also share it with civil society actors, including the INDH, student leaders, Mapuche leaders, and trade union leaders. I am also concerned by the use of preventive checks of demonstrators' identification by the police. That is, stopping individuals at random without specific evidence that they have committed or are about to commit a crime, asking for identification and detaining them if identification cannot be produced. While authorities told me that such controls are not performed in the context of protests, I received testimonies that such controls have indeed taken place previously. I view the use of such identity checks as a type of profiling or surveillance that has the potential to chill the exercise of the right to freedom of peaceful assembly. More worryingly, a bill enabling a wider use of preventive identity controls has been prepared and endorsed by the Chamber of Deputies. Authorities say that this law is necessary to stem a recent increase in criminal activity in Chile, but it is highly disturbing in two respects. First, giving law enforcement enhanced power and discretion will create opportunities for repression and abuse of authority, with little or no checks and balances. And indeed, when you look at how the stop and search measures have been used in countries like the United States of America, you find that without fail, consistently, they are used for those who are the most marginalized in society. They target blacks and Hispanics and the poor in the USA, despite the availability of accountability mechanisms in those stop and search measures in the US. Second, I'm not convinced that the law will be effective in combating crime. In fact, it may do the opposite. Allowing police to randomly detain anyone they choose without any evidence or identifiable suspicion is a shortcut that fosters lazy, counterproductive policing. Effective police forces can do their jobs without interfering with fundamental rights. And I'm confident that Chile's police force is effective and that it does not need nor will it benefit from such shortcuts. I therefore welcome the recent report by the Supreme Court, which stated that the preventive identity checks as envisaged in the bill on combating crime is difficult to accept in a democratic state. I am disturbed by the fact that human rights violations committed by law enforcement authorities can sometimes fall under military justice jurisdiction. This is highly problematic, as military courts do not offer sufficient guarantees of independence and impartiality in such cases. Consider the following statistics from the INDH. Between 1990 and 2011, 40,000 cases of police abuses were reported, but perpetrators were sanctioned in only 1.5% of these cases. This system and the impunity it fosters is among the most visible parts of the legacy of dictatorship. I welcome the decision of the Supreme Court last February in the Aiken case, which ruled that proceedings involving the police should be conducted by a civilian court, following a similar decision by the Constitutional Court. This is laudable, but a comprehensive reform of the Military Justice Code to ensure that military courts no longer have jurisdictions in cases of violations committed by or against security forces is of utmost urgency. This move is long overdue, for it has been 10 years since the Inter-American Court for Human Rights in the Palomara case ordered Chile to limit penal military jurisdiction to matters of military nature only. And the United Nations Human Rights Committee expressed a similar position last year. I am pleased to learn that the Ministries of Defense, Justice, and Interior are currently working on a bill to rectify this situation and return the police forces to full civilian oversight in all ways, as happens in democratic societies. This would be a landmark achievement and a further nail in the coffin of the dictatorship. Freedom of association. I'm encouraged to note that the right to freedom of association is generally respected in Chile, and I commend the state for the efforts made to ensure that individuals can organize themselves in order to achieve common purposes. However, while registration of associations appears to be uncomplicated for the purposes of obtaining legal personality, there appears to be very few opportunities to obtain funding. I would encourage the government of Chile to enhance its support and resources to the civil society sector, and especially the critical accountability organizations. The right to freedom of association is a necessary component through which individuals and communities participate in decisions that affect them. The Indigenous Peoples Act of 1993 favors types of associations for reclaiming land that may erode traditional structures and forms of organization. I'm aware the government is currently engaged in labor reform through a bill that will address some pressing issues, including guaranteeing the right to strike and narrowing the limitations imposed on the rights to those carrying out minimum services. However, this bill does not address the right of public sector workers to form trade unions, which is contrary to international law and standards. Moreover, it would broaden the category of workers prohibited from striking, banning action by those performing minimum services. International standards state that only workers providing essential services may face restrictions of their right to strike. It is also imperative that government ensures that all employers cease anti-union activities, such as targeting and firing workers for exercising their right to strike, which demeans that right. I urge the government to continue taking measures to bring its legislation into full compliance with ILO Conventions 87 and 98, as urged by ILO's Committee on Experts on the Application of Conventions and Recommendations. It is clear to me that the government values the contributions of the private sector to the economy and to policy, but it is not so obvious that it values civil society associations, including trade unions, in a similar manner. In line with my report to be presented to the UN General Assembly in October this year, I urge the government to facilitate an enabling environment for civil society similar to that accorded to businesses, for example, by considering their views and opinions in public policy of all sorts, as it does with businesses, academia, and experts. In conclusion, I would like to reiterate that Chile has made remarkable progress in the past 25 years. My observations and recommendations today are made with this fact in mind, and also with the knowledge that Chile has the capacity, the political will, and the maturity to continue to see this transition through. I will be presenting my full report to the Human Rights Council in Geneva in June of 2016. Thank you very much for your attention, and I welcome questions now.
Agradecemos entonces al relator especial Maina Kiai por compartirnos sus observaciones preliminares y a continuación vamos a abrir una ronda de preguntas. Para eso les pido que vayan levantando las manos, se les va a ir dando la palabra y una vez que esto sea así, les pido presentarse, por favor, su nombre y el medio al que representa. Comenzamos. Por favor.
Mr. Kiai, thank you. Good morning. There is a school in a military base in Chile called Fuerte Aguayo, where there is a school against to train international forces in this kind of repression you have been describing here. Riot control and repression. It's run by the Chilean military along with the police and the United States Southern Command. Do you think this school is part of your jurisdiction regarding this human rights issue? Because for any experienced observer, what you see in Chile is that special forces presented, the methods they employ are similar to those of Israeli occupation forces and apartheid South Africa. That it's very, very close, and pictures and movies, documentaries attest to that. So what would be your comment on this school and these similarities? Thank you.
That's it. Thank you very much for that question. Actually, I have not been made aware about the existence of this school. I will look into it. However, I want to say that the policing and the management of assembly and protests is a crucial issue. And the way states manage protests says a lot about their willingness to dialogue and their respect, really, for the right of people to come out together. we are seeing a trend, and we have seen a trend of militarization of policing of protests. So we saw that in Ferguson, USA recently. We've seen it in other parts of the world. This is a trend that needs to stop. And using military means to police civilians is always dangerous. The military are trained to deal with other militaries. They're trained to deal with force, not against unarmed civilians. But I want to say something as well, which is something that has disturbed me since I came here to Chile, which is the fact that it seems that every single time there's a protest, especially by students, by trade unions, and also sometimes in the Mapuche areas, at the end of the protest, some group of people come out and start causing violence, start hurting. I have asked the police and I've asked the authorities, why are you not arresting and apprehending this group? Everybody says it's a small group of people. Why is there no action being taken? Is there a purpose in perpetuating and allowing and tolerating this group to continue doing what it does? And talking to many people in Chile, they say that every single time a protest is called by students or workers, they know and they expect that there will be this gang of people causing chaos. So it's something that is worrying. But the net effect of not doing anything about it is that some people who want to protest then may not go because they don't want to be caught up in the violence. But even more important is that public opinion starts to change against protests. And I think that's something that the government of Chile needs to handle. It's not rocket science. It's not the first time that agents provocateurs have existed in the context of protests. It can be dealt with, and can be dealt with legally and within the rule of law to eliminate these sorts of actions that mar the really good use of protest and freedom of assembly.
Por favor, adelante.
En español, sí, está bien. Okay. Gracias por decirme. Mi nombre es Juan Pablo López, yo soy consultor, remito antecedente al sistema interamericano. El relator acaba de hablar de la legislación internacional y hacer una especie de referencia a los fallos de la Corte Interamericana. Lo que el relator no sabe, porque no se le ha informado de mala fe, de hecho, y se la mintió incluso por las autoridades chilenas que lo recibieron, es que Chile acaba de desahuciar los fallos de la Corte Interamericana, tal cual solamente lo ha hecho Venezuela. Al respecto le puedo decir que hay dos denuncias durante el año 2015, en abril de este año y en agosto de este año, en que expresamente se denuncia al Estado de Chile que a través de su judicatura acaba de desahuciar los fallos de la Corte Interamericana. Uno de los casos es un caso con notación nacional, el caso conocido de Martín Larraín Hurtado. Y resulta ser que cuál es la relación con el tema del relator. Resulta ser que la violación al derecho a reunión y asociación por cualquier ciudadano chileno, si se ve perturbado sus derechos, la manera de protegerlo es o ante una acción declarativa ante un tribunal civil o una vía más rápida a través de un recurso de protección ante las Cortes, solicitando el acatamiento de los fallos interamericanos y el ejercicio del control de convencionalidad. Cosa que, sin embargo, los tribunales se niegan a hacer. Hay como probarlo. Y de hecho, para probar esto, el abogado Fernando Leal Aravena, que es el abogado del caso de Diego Llavos, que por presiones del gobierno acaba ayer de ser sacado del caso, va a presentar un recurso de protección en contra del decreto que regula, digamos, las manifestaciones pacíficas, a efectos de que, si el equipo del relator lo permite y se le remite los antecedentes, va a poder corroborarlos por la página web del Poder Judicial, va a poder corroborar de primera fuente que el Estado chileno no cumple los tratados, que la Judicatura chilena no acata los fallos de la Corte Interamericana, que se niega a ejercer el control de convencionalidad. De hecho, el abogado también va a presentar un recurso de protección solicitando un requerimiento de solicitud de opinión consultiva al sistema interamericano en contra del proyecto de ley sobre control de identidad, exigiendo el acatamiento de los fallos de la Corte Interamericana para que el relator pueda ver que la Judicatura chilena se niega a acatar los fallos de la Corte Interamericana. Aspectos de esto, le puedo decir, el relator habló recién de la intervención de la judicatura militar en casos de violaciones de derechos fundamentales contra civiles. Lo que no sabe el relator, invocando también el fallo Palamar y Iribarne, es que en el caso, Quemados, la Corte Suprema, recientemente, como resulta ser que Fernández Vitus, el principal criminal imputado nuevamente, en el pasado se hizo un juicio que fue un fraude procesal, que se le estableció una pena mínima a él. Resulta ser que esa persona presentó un recurso de amparo solicitando la protección del doble juzgamiento. Cuando se le hizo ver a la Corte Suprema que la situación era una situación de cosa juzgada fraudulenta, se negó a declarar la cosa juzgada fraudulenta inmediatamente. La pregunta es si el relator va a disponer que personas de su equipo puedan recibir estos antecedentes, remitírselos para que los pueda incorporar en su informe final.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for that. Let me emphasize that this is a preliminary report. It's not finished. It's my initial findings. My report will be due in June of next year. I am happy, able, and willing to receive as much information as I can get between now and when we complete the report, which should be about end of April. So as much information as you've got, we're willing to look at it and make an assessment about it. So please feel free to give us information around that as you can get. That is still open. I want to, on the Inter-American Court, you know, I'm not so sure, I have not heard about this dismissal, but let me use that to say that international law, whether it's the Inter-American Human Rights Convention or the UN treaties that are done, once a country ratifies them, then it agrees deliberately and on its own, voluntarily, to fall under those confines, and which means then it must respect them. It must bring its law into conformity with international law. Sometimes citizens find something that they want to raise because it's popular. They feel it. And I know how crime, especially, can be very emotional. I come from a country where we have learned to live with crime. You know, I come from Kenya where criminality is very common. And citizens often demand greater action by the state to bring criminals in justice. However, the actions of the state in bringing crime down and in tackling crime have to be human rights friendly. So if citizens decide that there are so many criminals around and they want to kill them without taking them to court or to the police, the state must not pass a law to that effect, that it's all right to kill people who you consider to be criminals. That is not human rights. And even though it is a popular move, we saw recently how Americans were favoring torture in dealing with the war on terror. That doesn't mean it's right. And government has a duty and a responsibility to come up with alternative means of dealing with those situations that do not affect the fundamental freedoms of people. For as far as and one of the good things that I met with the Congress over the last few days, both Senate and the Chamber of Deputies, and they have accepted for me to send them analysis of the preventive ID bill that's there in terms of analyzing its confines and its restrictions to human rights. I hope they take it seriously. But I am worried that oftentimes we may cast a very broad net, but the impact with good intentions, very good intentions to bring down crime, but the impact of those good intentions is to affect the rights always of the weakest and most marginalized. And in the context of Chile, that is the youth, the poor, and the Mapuche. And as we see from examples, real life examples in the world, this is what happens. It happens in the US, it happens in other parts of the world. So I would urge Chileans and I would urge the government to think of alternative, because it's important to bring crime down. It's important to tackle crime. It's a fundamental issue as well. But it should not be tackled by reducing rights. There are other ways of doing it, and there are more effective and more efficient ways of dealing with it. So I wanted to raise those two things in that context. Thank you very much.
Gracias, Paulina, por favor.
Bueno, en primer lugar, agradecer esta extensa y profunda análisis a la situación del derecho a la reunión y de asociación en Chile. Me gustaría precisar en un punto, puesto que, insisto, el informe ha sido bastante completo y que tiene que ver con esta definición que usted hace y diferenciación más bien respecto a la autorización y notificación en un contexto de derecho a la manifestación. Lo hago por las consecuencias que usted bien ha señalado, a mi lado me acompaña precisamente Enrique Chin en el caso que usted ha señalado, y para poder también tener mayor claridad en lo que son las sucesivas manifestaciones que van a haber de aquí en adelante y hasta que haya el cambio sustantivo de este decreto. ¿Cuáles son los límites finalmente que la autoridad tiene en esto que usted define a objeto de facilitar y tomar medidas correspondientes? Lo pregunto porque hasta ahora hemos visto muchos casos en que las solicitudes son cambiadas en sus recorridos y llevadas a lugares muchas veces que son de mayor dificultad o que favorecen mayormente algunos hechos de violencia. También las notificaciones son dadas a última hora, incluso se han dado casos en que estas son dadas a las 11 de la noche fuera de horario de las intendencias y por supuesto con cambios de recorrido que los manifestantes no puedan asumir en esas horas. Entonces me gustaría que precisara por favor si estos alcances, es decir, la notificación, podría permitir o facultar a las autoridades hacer cambios en los recorridos propuestos por los manifestantes. Otro elemento que me gustaría al que hiciera referencia tiene que ver, usted señaló la gran cantidad, 40.000 casos de abusos de personas detenidas. Son por supuesto muchos más los miles de casos de personas que son detenidas cotidianamente en estas manifestaciones. Sin embargo, el número de formalizados es ínfimo y en muchos casos inexistente, es decir, son retenidos en estas comisarías sin que finalmente sean objeto de proceso alguno. Entonces me gustaría también que hiciera referencia a ello. Y finalmente, de cara a un punto que usted tocaba, yo soy periodista, soy comunicadora en derechos humanos, por lo tanto la formación de opinión pública es sumamente importante. Las estadísticas que se manejan con posterioridad a las manifestaciones por parte de los medios de comunicación son todas estadísticas que son entregadas por Carabineros de Chile. Claramente estadísticas no obedecen a la realidad ni tanto del número de manifestantes y nunca informan respecto de detenciones, menos aún de lesiones en estos contextos. Es más, en una audiencia ante la CIDH, que fue concedida específicamente para conocer las situaciones de violencia policial en el contexto de las manifestaciones de estudiantes, Carabineros de Chile informó que los lesionados en contexto de manifestación eran más en número los uniformados que los civiles manifestantes, cosa que simplemente es irrisoria. Así que me gustaría también su planteamiento respecto de las estadísticas, en tanto son el factor que permiten determinar, ¿verdad?, en un mejor sentido, cuál es el carácter que están tomando las manifestaciones públicas. Tal vez como usted planteaba, el INDH pueda estar en las comisarías, también puedan ellos mismos levantar estas estadísticas de lesiones y detenciones que puedan ser informadas a la prensa en ese mismo instante. Esas tres preguntas, solamente pensando en reforzar que el recurso de protección hasta ahora no ha resultado ser un recurso eficiente para proteger el derecho a la manifestación, han sido múltiples los casos que se han presentado para poder no solamente habilitar manifestaciones, sino frente a situaciones de abuso y ninguna de ellas han tenido eco.
Thank you very much for those questions. As I understood it, you're asking what kind of how notification would work. My understanding of notification is that, as opposed to authorization, is that when you notify the authorities, you tell them that in 2 days we will have a protest that's moving from here to there. Their job is to then marshal the resources to facilitate, to protect protesters, but also protect other people and other things. They can only chip in if there's another protest that's been requested before. So you can't have two protests at the same place at the same time. That's where it goes. So notification is simply informing them. Now, in terms, because I've heard this, I was told a lot about how routes are changed and roads are changed where you want to march. I think sometimes that can be appropriate, sometimes it's not appropriate. But again, it's important that it's a place that where the protection of the protesters is can be facilitated. It needs to be in sight and sound of the target of the protest, and it needs to be in a place where there's ability to flow. Of course, protesting, for example, in and blocking off a hospital would not be appropriate, for example, because people need to use hospital facilities. But there are others where, but those are very limited examples of limitations and restrictions. So notification gives protesters a bigger space. Now, if you're doing a protest, you don't want violence to mar it because it spoils it, and public opinion turns against you very quickly. So there is also what we consider recommendation that protesters, as they're doing so, also organize themselves to be able to manage the people around, so that at least they're able to control it in a little way. But again, it's important that if something happens, you know, there's a distinction here. If a few people are violent in a protest, that does not make the protest violent. The few people are violent, not the protest itself. So the job of the police is to extract those people from the protest and take them through the judicial processes for causing violence. But let the protesters go. And in fact, statistics have shown that the maximum number you find of violent people in a protest is often between 5 to 10% maximum. The rest of people are peaceful. They want to go ahead, they want to make their point. They want to go on and do their thing. So it's important in that sense. With regard to the question of figures and statistics that the police give to the media and the media use, I know there's nothing that stops police from doing so. It's their right. It's up to you all and all of us to find different information which we think is accurate. And then we can challenge the police and say, why do you say it's only 30,000 and actually it's 100,000? And why do you say the people injured was only, the civilians and the protesters injured are 5 and this? It's really a work among yourselves. You have to do that. It's not, I mean, I think the police are doing something which is trying to get sympathy. I think it's up to you all to do the same thing. So you cannot create a law to say the police have to show the numbers accurately. I mean, I think you do want, there cannot be a human rights law. There can be an integrity and ethical issue. So you can take that through ethics and integrity, but it cannot be within human rights. I think the within human rights, there's the INDH, the civil society, there's the media as well, which we hope would be honest and upfront, and hopefully they will also follow these things up. But I think that there's an important role for monitors of protests, so people can actually monitor, whether they are media monitors, civil society monitors, national human rights institution monitors, but a variety of monitors, including actually, by the way, the UN. And under the Rights Up Front initiative of Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, there is an obligation that the UN also monitors and preserves human rights. So I think it's up to you all now to start pushing the UN, and not just the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. The entire UN has an obligation to put rights up front. So if there's a massive protest, then it's important that you go to the res rep of the UN and tell him and tell her, with this massive, can you deploy your monitors to come out and see it? Because now there is a duty within the United Nations to respect rights and to make sure that. So, but that duty, there is of course resistance from within the UN, because many of these agencies have no understanding of what human rights is. So it's something that you'll have to educate them. Maybe the National Institute can do some courses with the office OACHR for the UN agencies that are in Chile to help them be able to really put rights up front where it's supposed to be. But there's work to be done. I think the systems are not perfect yet. There's a lot of work to be done on that score.
Sí, adelante. Hola, ¿cómo están? Muy buenas tardes. Soy Beatriz del Canal 13. Primero, me gustaría preguntarle respecto a un ejemplo que usted mencionó dentro del informe preliminar, que tiene que ver con los camioneros. Le quería preguntar, uno, ¿Cómo le parece, o qué le parece la reacción que tuvo el gobierno cuando los camioneros de Temuco quisieron ingresar a la Alameda y el gobierno envió un decreto para evitar que ellos pudieran llegar a Santiago? Estuvieron en la carretera sin poder entrar debido a este decreto. Dos, también le quería preguntar si usted ha podido ver la ley antiterrorista. Hay mucho debate respecto a cuándo esta ley puede ser aplicable, sobre todo con situaciones relacionadas al pueblo mapuche. Y también preguntarle, hoy usted se reúne con la presidenta Michelle Bachelet, ¿qué es lo que le va a pedir a la mandataria?
Okay, that's the interesting questions, very different. On the truckers issue, I met with the truckers, with the representatives of the truckers in Temuco. They said they wanted to come to Santiago to protest. Now, whether people agree or don't agree with them really is irrelevant. The issue is that everybody has a right to freedom of assembly. It is a facilitating right. It is not a content right. And as long as the purpose of the assembly is peaceful, it is not, does not incite violence, does not incite hatred and division, it is fine. And of course, yes, trucks in a city disrupt, absolutely, absolutely. But that is the purpose of assemblies. That is the purpose. And the truckers say, whether they're right or wrong, I don't know, but they say they try to get government to follow up the issue. Government didn't. So they said, okay, if government cannot come to us, we will go to government. It's their right to do so. So I think that is that for me is an issue that is important. It's not about the content, it's about the right. Facilitating people to express themselves jointly and in unison as groups and collectives. That's what's important. So I think you know, we're going to be continuing to research on this matter to see exactly where it's at. But I'm very clear that assemblies are not about the content. It's about the tool. And in any case as well, in the context of the conflicts with the Mapuche people and within that part of the country, as I said in my remarks, I don't make a judgment about who's right or who's wrong. However, what I do make a judgment about is that facilitating freedom of association and assembly and expression will help deal with this issue in a much more pleasant, much more easier, non-violent manner. That's the key, that if we allow that free, if we allow freedom to reign, we will find a way, even though it may take time, it may be rowdy, it may be messy, it's the best way to deal with this issue so people feel that they can peacefully engage and fight for whatever it is they're fighting without having to resort to violence. That to me is important. On the terrorism law, I am aware that my colleague, Special Rapporteur on human rights in the context of counterterrorism was here, made a report. It's a report which we will be considering in the context of our report where it affects freedom of assembly and association. I think that where terrorist laws are used, because they've been used in a number of countries, to limit freedom of association and freedom of assembly, they are illegal. So even counterterrorism laws should not be a back way to limit freedom of assembly and association. What we know under international law is that there are restrictions to the right of freedom of assembly and association, and those are clear and sufficient within the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. They're very clear, public order and they are in the minority. They are the exception rather than the rule. And I think we cannot have consistent restrictions being applied because of this, unless there's a real order of emergency and it's a limited order of emergency. As to the meeting we're going to have with the president, I think there'll be a number of things to discuss, of course, within the context of my mandate. Oftentimes these discussions flow in a very organic way. But I think one of the things I'll ask is about Decree 1086 of 1983, which I understand is an executive order, which can then be repealed by executive decision. So the question I'll ask her is, why doesn't she repeal Executive Order 1086 of 1983, which goes back to an era that is very painful for most Chileans? Why is that law, why is that decree, why is that executive order still existing?
Buenas tardes, Rolf Paso de CNN Chile. Preguntarle, de todos los temas que usted ha hablado, ¿cuál cree que es el problema más grave hoy en nuestro país y que requiere una solución más inmediata? Y si le va a pedir a la presidenta Michelle Bachelet que retroceda en la idea del control preventivo de identidad que ya fue aprobado por la Cámara de Diputados.
You know, you in human rights, you try not to grade them. You know, I think all human rights are important, and so we don't try and grade them. But I think the common thread that I have found in the short time I've been here, and I recognize the short time that I've been here and studying these issues, is the fact that the vestiges of the dictatorship still continue, still exist. Those vestiges relating to 1086, to the securitization of the society, the role of special forces, the fact that the response to increased criminality and crime is increased powers to the carabineros. So all those things actually are one. It's how does a country which has made a lot of progress and wants to make further progress for sure, how does a country like that, and within a context as well where the transition from dictatorship to democracy was a negotiated one, where there were limits that were placed. How do you shift? How do you move and remove those elements that restrain rights, while maintaining a security environment for everybody, the crime-free environment that maintains the ability to continue producing and doing economic activity, that protects workers and makes sure that workers are protected. So, a lot of the issues I've raised have their roots in the Pinochet era, in the Pinochet dictatorship. And I think that's what the issue would be, really. You know, when will Chile finally end the Pinochet era? Okay. Last question.
Control preventivo.
Alex Pijiger.
Disculpa. Sí.
Sí, faltó su respuesta con respecto al control preventivo de identidad. Si le va a pedir a la presidenta Michelle Bachelet que retroceda en esta iniciativa que ya fue aprobada por la Cámara de Diputados.
Absolutely. I mean, I will raise it up with her. I've raised it up here. I mean, this document that I've got will be presented to her. The final report of my mission will be presented to her. So this is not the end of it, I think. And the fact that the analysis that I will do in the coming weeks, which I'll be sending to the Congress, I will also present it to her so that we can see how those are done. So it is an issue of concern. And I appreciate the fact that a vast majority of people support this ID controls. They support them. But I think that the danger that they carry is way more than the benefits people think they'll get. And there's enough experience in different countries to show that.
Ahora sí, disculpa, adelante.
Alex Mejía, de periodista de la Federación Supervisora del Cobre. Ponerle apellido a una huelga, por ejemplo, ponerle el apellido de Pacífico, por ejemplo, ¿no constituye restringir este derecho de alguna manera?
Say again.
Ponerle el apellido de Pacífico a una huelga, a una manifestación en el fondo de los trabajadores, ¿de alguna forma no restringe el derecho en sí mismo que está, digamos, refrendado en la Constitución?
You know, I think we've got to make it clear that peaceful, in my view, means non-violent. A strike, a protest, is meant to disrupt. That is the purpose of it. But, and it's and often within human beings, is not the first thing people try. People try and, in the context of workers, they try and have negotiations and say, look, we need health insurance. And the employer says, sorry, I won't do so, or I can't afford it, whatever it is. There's a negotiation, hopefully. When negotiations break down, that's when people say, okay, we are going to go on strike. And it is meant to disrupt, but it can do so in a non-violent manner. That, to me, is the key. It's a non-violent manner, okay? But you can't have a strike, you know, and one of the questions, in fact, which I have found here is the right that employers have got, especially with outsourced workers, the right employers have got that when you go on strike, you can be replaced immediately. That demeans the right, because if you're replaced, then what's the use of going on strike? So these are issues that I think the government should look at, because nobody wants to go in the hot sun or the cold winter of Chile to strike and be out in the streets. It's not the best use of your time. So it comes up when people, when other means of communication have failed. Yeah.
Bueno, damos por finalizada en este momento. Sabemos que hay preguntas adicionales, pero infelizmente debemos cerrar la conferencia en este momento. Les invitamos de todas formas a hacernos llegar a través de nuestros medios de comunicación digital el resto de preguntas que no fueron respondidas en esta conferencia. Perdón, lamentamos informarles que no se van a distribuir los documentos impresos en este momento, porque ha habido algunos detalles adicionales, pero sí se van a distribuir a través de email y nuestros medios sociales dentro de los próximos minutos, así que les rogamos comunicarse con nosotros en caso de no recibirlos. Nuevamente agradecerles por su presencia, por acompañarnos, por sus preguntas, y quedamos a disposición. Perdón, algo más.
Muchas gracias.
Muchas gracias a todos.
Yeah, because there are some changes.